all through thunder. Please be seated.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Okay, we have been studying the Salaika Sutta. This is Sutta number 8 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And we are on now page 127. And last time I explained that in the sutta, in the section on effacement, the Buddha deals with 44 types, if you call them, unwholesome states, unwholesome qualities. And all of these qualities are to be overcome or eliminated by the practice of what is called effacement. The word effacement, it's somewhat obscure in English, but we can understand it as the gradual wearing away, the gradual elimination of defilements. And last week I went through these 44 unwholesome qualities and we examined them and we saw how they fall into certain fixed, most of them fall into certain fixed sets. The 10 unwholesome courses of action. We have the, which are to be overcome by following the 10 wholesome courses of action. Then we have the 8-fold wrong path to be countered by following the 8-fold right path or noble path, and so on. The 5 hindrances to be overcome by methods for eliminating the hindrances, 10 or so of the 16 corruptions of the mind, and 7 good qualities, or 7 bad qualities and their opposites, the 7 good qualities. And now, when we look at the sutta, we see that these 44 unwholesome qualities and their opposites are explored or treated in terms of 5 sections. These are 5 ways of dealing with these unwholesome qualities of mind. The first of these sections is the section on effacement. And this takes the form of each one is expressed by the formula in which one thinks. Taking the first one as an example, others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel here. Effacement should be practiced thus. So in this case, one makes this resolution that even though others might be behaving in a particular way, even though others might be exhibiting certain unwholesome qualities, that one will not follow their example, but one will strike out on the way that one sees to be the good, proper, wholesome way to follow. And by making this resolution, this determination, this is a form of effacement, of working to wear away, to erode away these unwholesome qualities. Now it seems to me that the next sections present a kind of sequence of development. I don't know whether they are to be seen as developing the practice of effacement further or actually starting with the beginning. It seems to me that almost with the section called Inclination of Mind, we start at the very beginning. We go back to the beginning, so to speak, and then trace the process of overcoming the unwholesome states through certain stages. And so here, the Buddha says, I say that even the inclination of mind towards wholesome states is of great benefit. So what should be said of bodily and verbal acts conforming to such a state of mind? And here I will write this, a very important Pali expression used here. Chitu pada, the Chinese would be fa shin, fa shin. Yeah, now this word can be understood. I think inclination of mind, not a good translation. And I have to take the blame for this. I don't remember what Venerable Nyanamoli's original rendering was, but I think I had substituted what his original rendering. I had replaced it with this. But I think it's not so good. Now, citta-pada can have the sense of either arising of the mind or production of the mind. In other words, either a mind that arises spontaneously or the deliberate arousing of this particular state of mind. And so just from citta-pada, would not be able to tell. But from the following expression, the number one, mind should be inclined thus, it becomes clear, and then the Pali makes it even clearer. Chitam upadetabang. That upadetabang indicates that's a causative form, which means one should cause to arise. In other words, one should arouse or produce the mind. One should give rise to such a state of mind. So inclination of mind is very weak when one considers that against the original Pali text. And so the Buddha is here saying that even the production of the mind, the arising, the arousing of the mind towards wholesome states, is of great benefit. So what should be said of would be the disposing of the body and of speech in the direction of such a state of mind? In other words, what should be said of acting or speaking in conformity with such a state of mind? And with this statement, the Buddha is indicating that the arousing, the deliberate cultivation of the mind, of the intention, is the most important starting point in the development of the entire wholesome way of life. That if one doesn't make a deliberate effort to cultivate wholesome intentions, wholesome resolutions, wholesome determinations, if one just leaves it to chance, sometimes one will do what is proper, other times one will follow one's own inclinations. When one follows inclinations, they usually lead in unwholesome directions. So if one just follows one's own inclinations, then one will usually get into trouble. So here, the Buddha is emphasizing the importance of generating, producing the disposition of mind towards the wholesome, making the resolution Then the commentary elaborates on this passage and explains how everything wholesome in the practice of the Buddha Dhamma begins with the arising of the appropriate state of mind. So it's through generating the determination at the very beginning of one's life as a Buddhist, I will take the three refuges and five precepts, that one then undertakes the action of undertaking the refuges and precepts. It is through making the determination, arousing this mind, I will practice generosity, that one then undertakes acts of generosity. It's through making the determination that arising of the mind, sometimes in some people the mind will arise, the thought will arise, that I want to cultivate the mind through meditation. But if the mind, that thought just arises now and again, then one doesn't make the determined effort. But it's when one arouses the mind, makes that determined effort, arouses that mind, generates the resolution, that is that resolution that will guide one in entering upon this practice. And then, of course, the commentators are monks, and so then they say, well, it's the resolution, if the mind arises, that I will go forth into homelessness. So that thought arises, but if you just let the thought arise, then it will fade away. But at a certain point, when the thought arises, then one has to turn it into that resolution, determination, I will go forth into homelessness. Then one wants to develop the meditation subject up to the level of the jhanas, again, one has to make the resolution, I will develop the jhanas. One wants to develop insight, one has to arouse that mind to develop insight. And so everything depends upon the resolution. And in the case, even those who become arhats, Buddhas, that happens because there arises that determination, that resolution. First, either the resolution, the mind wishing to be entirely liberated, free from the round of samsara, or there arises the mind wishing to achieve complete enlightenment of Buddhahood. That is Chittopada. It all comes about through the arising of the appropriate state of mind. Now, in the case of the practice for effacement, here the Buddha says that one should arouse the mind for each of these 44 ways of eliminating the unwholesome states. The text here is abridged, so it just begins first, second, then we go jump right ahead to the 44th. Now, it's very useful for one's personal development. This is what I often recommend. If you try to develop all 44 of these, you'll think it's too much, cannot do it. But look through the list and try to find three or four that particularly applicable to yourself, and then make the resolution, arouse that mind every day. Just do it once a day, maybe twice a day if you have that problem, if it's really a difficult problem. Once in the morning after waking up, once in the evening before going to sleep. If you're disposed to get angry easily, make the resolution, I will not get angry, but I will remain patient even under difficult conditions. If you are disposed to be lazy and postpone things that have to be done, you make the resolution, I will not be lazy, but I will be energetic and diligent. If you are disposed to be insolent, whatever. I will not be insolent, but I will be polite and considerate towards others. If you dispose, whose problem is this? To be obstinate, make the determination, I will not be obstinate, but I will be flexible, yielding, then if you're disposed to adhere to your own views, to hold on to them tenaciously, relinquish them with difficulty, you can use the reflection that I will relinquish, I will just be concerned with the truth, not to hold to my own views. Remember I was telling you last week about my when I first became interested in Buddhism and I was learning from this monk who was my first teacher. After 3 months or so, I thought I knew more Buddhism than he did, so I would always, based on my reading of the Ramakrishna Mission Swamis, of their writings on Buddhism, and Alan Watts, so I would argue with him. Usually the arguments centered around the view whether the Buddha's teaching of anatta means, as my teacher would say, that means that there is no self. But since I was reading Watts and the Swamis, they were saying the Buddha's teaching of anatta means that there's really the big, great, universal self. And I would hold that view very strongly. That I would say, okay, the Buddha's teaching of anatta means no individual, private, finite self, no limited ego. But I was holding that view so strongly that it seemed that I was really believing not in the big universal self, but in the finite, limited ego, my own ego. But finally, when he taught me, you have to be concerned not with whether your view is right, not with whether the other person is wrong. Just think, whether I'm right or wrong, that doesn't make any difference. The important thing is to find out the truth. And that was very useful. Of course, there were a few other things, I think. My views are true and his are false. Even today. And so, just go through and you'll find that it's very, very helpful to do this. You don't do it just 1 or 2 days and then think, well, I've tried it already. It isn't working. Here it is the 3rd day and I'm still getting angry. I'm still lazy. I'm still obstinate. It's not a matter of 2 days, 3 days, but do it every day like this. You'll see after a few months that it makes a big difference. It's a process of salaka, gradual wearing away. Again, this is like the example of the water that gradually can wear away. You see in the stream, sometimes the water is continually flowing down the stream, and a little stream of water is coming and hitting on the rock. And you see that place in the rock that the water is hitting. You'll see it's a convex surface, that it's indented. How did that happen? Not because the water has been hitting that rock 1 or 2 days, but just over months and years, the water wears away the rock. And so when one produces the appropriate state of mind, it will wear away the unwholesome states of mind. Okay, so this is the inclination of mind, or better, the production of mind, the arousing of the mind. And here the arousing of mind is the arousing of the resolution, the arousing of the determination. Okay, now the next section on page 128, this is called the avoidance section. The Pali word is suggestive, parikamana. It means literally walking around. Okay, so the Buddha uses an example, a simile. He says, suppose there were an uneven path. This is a rough road, a road with maybe rocks, gravel, thorns, and another even road by which to avoid it. If you're driving along your car, country, down the country area, and you come to two roads branching out, you can take either road. One road is a gravel road, rough, with a lot of bumps, dips, potholes. And then there's a smooth, even road. And so you would avoid the rough, rugged road, and you would take that smooth, even road. Of course, you don't want to damage your car. Or if you're walking, you don't want to. Well, here we wear shoes, so it doesn't matter. But I'm thinking in South Asia, people often walk barefoot. And so one wants to avoid getting the feet in hurt, so one takes the even road. And so I think this section now is taught, and so just to complete, the Buddha says, and so too, a person giving to cruelty has non-cruelty by which to avoid it. Then he continues, okay, with the 10 unwholesome courses of action, one given to killing living beings has abstention from killing living beings by which to avoid it. And so all the ways down to the last one, one given to adhere to his own views and so on, has non-adherence to his own views and so on, by which to avoid it. I think this passage can be understood from several points of view. For one thing, here the Buddha is teaching that for every unwholesome state of mind, for every unwholesome quality, there is some remedy for that quality. There is some way to overcome it. And this is one of the most striking things, most impressive things about the Buddha's teaching, is that for all the different defilements of the human mind, whether it be defilements expressed in bodily action, defilements expressed in speech, defilements in thought, the Buddha has some antidote for those defilements. That's why the Buddha is called the great physician. Because a great physician doesn't just have one medicine for every patient, but the great physician knows that patients that come to him will have many, many different illnesses. And so that great physician will have many medicines to prescribe. He'll know many different types of treatment. And so the Buddha understands completely the workings of the mind. He knows all of the weaknesses of human nature, all of the proclivities, the obstacles that human beings face, and he knows the way to overcome those weaknesses, the way to break through those barriers and obstacles. And so he teaches all of these different remedies or antidotes for the different defilements and unwholesome ways. And so this passage is stated in order to say that for every defect, for every obstruction, there is some way to overcome them. And I think this passage now is stated here because this is the appropriate passage after one has produced the determination, produced that resolution to cultivate the wholesome. Then one sets out on the path. And so as one is walking along the path, then one will sometimes meet new obstacles that one hasn't expected to encounter. Say, a person who is given to a person should definitely always be observing the 10 courses of wholesome action. But somebody might be angry and resentful. Okay, and so they're working on overcoming anger and resentment. Then suddenly they might notice something new in their character. Maybe once they get some success in overcoming anger and resentment, suddenly they become arrogant and start thinking that now I've become free from anger, free from resentment, I'm so full of, so patient, so full of kindness and consideration, I'm so much better than other people. These other people are always getting angry and upset, but I'm so much more patient than they are. And so then they start becoming arrogant. That's number 33. Then they start, when somebody says to them, you shouldn't be arrogant, then they get difficult to admonish. What do you mean telling me I shouldn't be arrogant? You're just a beginner. I've been working on this path now for 3 months. I'm a veteran already. Okay, so new faults arise in one's character. And so when one starts seeing these new faults appear, then if they become apparent to oneself or other people points them out, then one has to realize that there are ways to overcome those faults. Or somebody might have a lot of faith. They might be very humble, very patient, but they might lack mindfulness and wisdom, number 42, 43. Then they should realize that they have to develop mindfulness and wisdom, and that there are ways to develop mindfulness and wisdom. And so then they would look at number 42 and 43. One given by to unmindfulness has the establishment of mindfulness by which to avoid it. One given to lack of wisdom has the acquisition of wisdom by which to avoid it. And so whenever one sees some weak spot, some defect in one's character, then one will check that defect against this list of unwholesome qualities and see that there's some way to avoid it. Because this is a concise sutta, the text doesn't specify in detail how does one develop mindfulness, how does one acquire wisdom. But to get those details, then one will turn to call a spiritual friend, somebody who knows the Buddha's teachings well for advice, or else if one studies the Buddha's teachings in detail, one will find more detailed explanations in other suttas. So when you know the entire body of the suttas, then you can fill in the details just by putting passages from the text together. Okay, so that is the passage on ways of avoidance. And now, the fourth section, this is very important, this is called the way leading upwards. It actually should be the way leading downwards and the way leading upwards. And this introduces an important fact about unwholesome and wholesome states, that one has to take into account, that one should not look at them lightly, not consider them lightly, not be negligent regarding them. But what one needs is the quality of heedfulness. And heedfulness, appamada, means in part that one recognizes that one's qualities of mind, qualities of character, one's actions have consequences. They have consequences in this very life itself, and consequences for our future life. Consequences for our long-term future extending over many lives. And one shouldn't take this, if one really understands the Buddha's teaching, just as myth, legend, or Indian cultural accretions. Now it's very fashionable to say that all of these teachings of karma, rebirth, that this is just part of the Indian cultural heritage of Buddhism. But now we are much more sophisticated today in the West, so we can get rid of all of this and we just have a Buddhism that we can practice here and now. Buddhism for today. But the Buddha says that we have to consider things really from a very long-term perspective. And when we consider unwholesome and wholesome qualities, states from the long-term perspective, he says, ye kechi akusala dhamma sabbe te adobhavang kamaniya. That is, whatever unwholesome qualities there are, all of them lead downwards. They go downwards. How do they go downwards? First, they lead downwards within ourselves. That is, when these unwholesome qualities arise in the mind, okay, naturally they arise through long-term conditioning. That can't be helped. But if we let them go, if we don't pay attention to them, if we just let them drop into the mind, they are like weeds that drop into a garden. And if we don't take any measures to clear out that garden, then when the seeds of those weeds drop into the garden, those seeds are going to drop down, send down their roots, send up their sprouts, and proliferate. So before long, the garden gets completely overrun by the weeds. No more beautiful flowers, no more shrubs, no more trees, no more nice fruit trees. But everything is covered by weeds, and by wild trees that destroy the beautiful fruit trees. And so the unwholesome qualities, the unwholesome thoughts, unwholesome intentions that we let go drop into the mind, they send down roots and they sprout, and gradually they start to overcome our mind and take possession of the mind until our character gets shaped by those thoughts, by those intentions. Those thoughts, those intentions, those inclinations proliferate. It's sort of like, not simply like weeds, but it's like an underground network of weeds. Is there a special name for that? see that they send down roots which spread. Actually, in Pali, that's the idea. It's a maluva creeper. They send down they send down roots under the ground and they spread till I grow up everywhere. This is the creeper that creeps above ground, the maluva creeper, in the forest, and it spreads, it grows along the surface of the ground, then it sends up a shoot which climbs up a tree, winds around the tree, then other shoots go along the ground and climb up other trees, and they wind around the tree, then they grow all over the tree, then they become so massive that they prevent the tree from growing, they stunt the growth of the tree, and eventually they become so heavy that they could cause the tree to collapse. There's a sutta about that. I think it's number 45 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, so this is the way unwholesome states take root in our character. They pull the character, the mind, downwards. And then also those unwholesome states, they will generate, when they get sufficient strength, they will generate unwholesome actions, and they will lead downwards in terms of our future development, future migration within the realm of existence, within samsara. They will lead downwards to lower forms of rebirth. And once one takes rebirth in the lower realm, then it becomes very difficult to find the way upwards back into the human realm or the higher realm. That is why a human realm or a divine rebirth is something very precious, very valuable. And so we have to take very, very strong measures to protect our human dignity, and not allow the unwholesome states to pull us down to lower realms of existence. But then the positive side is that whatever wholesome states there are, ye kechi kusala dhamma sabbe te upari bhavang kamaniya, whatever wholesome states there are, they all lead upwards. That is, the wholesome states, those states we have to deliberately cultivate. We have to cultivate with right effort, with energy, with diligence. But when we cultivate them, they lead upwards. They lead to the purification of the character. They lead to the nobility of our character. They lead to the growth of wisdom. And they lead upwards to higher states of rebirth. They will lead us back into the human realm, to rebirth in divine realms. And eventually they will lead us to enlightenment, to Nibbana. And now, in this antithesis or this opposition between the unwholesome states and the wholesome states, the Buddha says that, again, for each of these defiled states, we have the wholesome opposite to lead us upwards. So if we are disposed to cruelty, or to harmfulness, to harming others, or if a person even has some sadistic trait, enjoys tormenting animals, that person has non-cruelty, developing a mind of compassion to lead him upwards. And so for each of the other 43, 44 states, one given to killing living beings, as abstaining from killing living beings to lead upwards, one given to adhere to his own views, and so on, as non-adherence to his own views to lead upwards. Okay, now we come to the fifth section. And now the Buddha sounds a rather stern warning. I think that warning comes now because now we are taking the upward path, we are going upwards, upwards, upwards. And as one goes upwards, one might start thinking that, okay, now I've reached a certain high level, I can stop here, I don't have to go any further. And so he says, Chunda, that one who is himself sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud, that is impossible. That one who is not himself sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud, that is possible. That one who is himself untamed, undisciplined, and with defilements unextinguished, should tame another, discipline him, and help extinguish his defilements, that is impossible. That one who is himself tamed, disciplined, with defilements extinguished, should tame another, discipline him, and help extinguish his defilements, that is possible. Okay, so this is a kind of warning to those who are not yet themselves out of the mud to take upon themselves the role to think that they could start pulling others out of the mud, to start taming, disciplining, and liberating others. I know you might be thinking, okay, then what are you? That is, what am I doing up here giving a lecture? And I agree with you. I'm not out of the mud yet myself, and I really should take Buddha's advice to heart, close the books and go back to my room and just meditate all the time. But nowadays, if foolish people like me don't talk on Dhamma, then people who are even more foolish will talk. They won't be challenged. They're talking anyway, but they won't be challenged. So, what to do? But I don't think that we have to take this statement to mean that one shouldn't speak on Dhamma until one is completely enlightened, completely liberated. But I think this is a warning that one shouldn't really consider oneself fully capable of liberating others while one still has work to do. And especially when one is really sunk in the mud, still overwhelmed by defilements, one should not start setting oneself up in the position of being a teacher. Too many, I have to say, who make maybe a little progress in meditation, a little progress in learning in the past, even nowadays, start thinking, now I'm ready to become a Dharma teacher. And then usually you get like a, what do you call this, a curriculum vitae or like biofile, is that what it's called? Biosketch. So-and-so spent 3 years as a monk in Asia. Now he's back in America. Why didn't he stay a monk? And and so one has to go about this in a very cautious way when one is teaching, and not jump in and start thinking, I've gotten a little knowledge, now I'm ready to start pulling everybody else out from the mud. And there's an important word here which is impossible to translate properly into English. The word rendered unextinguished and extinguished, because this is the word with overtones. The Pali word is unextinguished. Okay, the word unextinguished is with the balance that one who is himself untamed, undisciplined, unextinguished. Put it into English, we have to say with defilements unextinguished, but the Pali is better, aparini bhuto. Now, one could also translate this, you see, the word parini bhuto means one who has attained nibbana. Parini bhuto, nibbuto is the past participle that is used to indicate attained nibbana. The prefix form, parinibbuto. Parinibbuto is one who has attained nibbana. Aparinibbuto is one who has not attained nibbana. And then the phrase that's given here at the end of this paragraph, help extinguishes defilements. Again, it's a makeshift because the Pali has parinibbapesati, which means, could be translated, and cause him to attain nirvana. In other words, what's being implied here is helping somebody to attain nirvana, to bring somebody to nirvana. And so one who has not attained nibbana himself, herself, will not be able to help another to attain it. But we shouldn't say it that way, to cause another to attain it. Whereas one who has done so can bring another to nibbana. That's being implied. And now this is used, this idea of extinguishing is used not in relation to one person helping another to extinguish the defilements, but that one person, himself, herself, has the ability to extinguish his or her own defilements. And the way to do that is to use the wholesome qualities, each of the 44 wholesome qualities, to extinguish the unwholesome opposite. So, for example, a person given to cruelty has non-cruelty to extinguish it. And the word to extinguish it here is parinibbanaya. Literally, it would be for bringing the person given to cruelty has non-cruelty for bringing cruelty to nirvana. Might translate it that way, a sort of play on words here, because the idea of nirvana is extinguishing. So what one is extinguishing is the fire of the unwholesome states with the wholesome opposite. And so for each of the 44 unwholesome qualities, one uses the wholesome opposite. One conceives of the 44 unwholesome qualities as being like a fire, and the 44 wholesome qualities as being like water. And one uses that water of the wholesome qualities to extinguish the unwholesome qualities. And by extinguishing the unwholesome qualities, one brings oneself to nibbana. And I said when we started this talk that the five these four sections seem to unfold in a sequence, and this last one we can see is the culmination of the sequence. Exactly how the first one, the one on effacement, fits in, it's a little troublesome, a little trouble understanding. But taking the inclination of mind or the arousing of the mind, we can see that as the starting point. One begins by producing that determination, that resolution to cultivate the wholesome states, to overcome the unwholesome states by cultivating the wholesome states. Then one walks along the path by avoiding the unwholesome states and practicing the wholesome states. That's the section on avoidance. Then, as one goes along, one realizes that one is avoiding the downward path of the unwholesome states, and one is moving upwards further and further by cultivating the wholesome states. But now, as one is making progress, one needs this warning not to set oneself up prematurely as a savior, a liberator of others. One could help others, share one's knowledge, one's understanding with others, but don't neglect the work on oneself. Then one has to keep on working and use the wholesome methods as the means of extinguishing the unwholesome qualities. And when all of the unwholesome qualities are extinguished, then the work is done. Then one is liberated. And so then the Buddha sums up his discourse, paragraph 17. He says, "So Chunda, the way of effacement has been taught by me, the way of inclining the mind, or now I would prefer, the way of generating the mind, or generating the resolution, has been taught by me. The way of avoidance has been taught by me. The way leading upwards has been taught by me. And the way of extinguishing has been taught by me." And now the Buddha says, "What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you, Chunda. There are these roots of trees, there are these empty huts. Meditate, Chunda, do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you." And that is the discourse on the face. Maybe if anybody has any ideas of how the first section, the way of effacement, fits in, I'd be interested to hear. If you see that the other sections form a gradual sequence, how that section fits in. I've been thinking about it, but I don't have a solution. Yeah.
My only thought is that they are meant to explain the way of effacement. That they are the gradual removing of the defilements.
So that the other four
are explaining the first one.
That's the way. That's the only way that I could make sense out of it. But then, one would expect the Buddha say, "I will teach you the way of effacement." And what is the way of effacement? It is. First, there is the way of generating the mind, then the way of avoidance, then the way of leading upwards, then the way of extinguishing. As I said, the way of effacement is put in almost as though it's a separate process in its own right. That's why I get stumped. But unless there's a better idea, then I think we'll have to agree that that is the correct interpretation.
Did we have an understanding of why he's talking about effacement at all? Because that wasn't Chunda's original question.
Yeah. It's a question why discourse slides into talk about effacement, when it's not the topic that's originally raised, this is what my hypothesis would be. Maybe I don't have a definite hypothesis.
I guess the reason I'm asking is I'm kind of curious why he's talking about it. Maybe if you understood why he was talking about effacement to begin with, you can understand.
What I would suppose is that, okay, Chunda comes with this question about, this is in paragraph 3 of the sutta. Apparently there are some monks who have been still in the beginning of their training, and they think that they have been abandoning and relinquishing these views about the world and about the self. In other words, this means that they think that they've attained the first stage of awakening, the stage of stream entry. And then the Buddha corrects this misunderstanding and says that these views that arise in the world connected with doctrines of the self or about the world, these views are abandoned when one sees things with proper wisdom. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Okay, so this implies that some people have been overrating their achievements. So this overrating the achievement or overestimating oneself is the kind of defilement or mistake, is a kind of mistake about oneself, putting oneself up too high. And now there would also be some practitioners, I think now the Buddha's changing the topic, but it's still within a parallel track, that there are other meditators who have been attaining the jhanas, and they are thinking that they are, by attaining the jhanas, that they are eliminating defilements. This is effacement. And the Buddha now wants to point out that these attainments of the jhanas, that this is not effacement, not the elimination of defilements, but just pleasant abidings. And so the parallelism here, let's put it this way.
A vaping.
So I think we might see a parallelism here. Okay, the question, the opening question is about beginners in the development of insight who make the mistake of thinking that they are abandoning views. In other words, that they are stream enterers. And then the Buddha says this is not the case. It's not just at the beginning of insight, but it is when one contemplates everything as non-self that one is able to abandon the views. Okay, then we shift to a different topic, but one that is parallel. The Buddha brings up the case of those who are attaining the jhanas and then the formless attainments, and they think they are abiding in effacement, in other words, that they are removing defilements. And the Buddha says this is not the case, but the way to overcome, to remove the defilements, the correction, is by practicing these 44 ways in the 5 sections.
Salaika
is the word. Yeah.
Does it appear with some sort of greater frequency in other books of the canon? There's only one other reference in the whole Nishima Nikaya.
Yeah, it doesn't occur frequently at all. I don't think it occurs in the Samyutta Nikaya at all. Anguttara Nikaya, I'm not sure, but probably not very often. It's not a common term.
Of the vast similes and ways he brings out the Eightfold Path and the practice, it just strangely launches into such a detailed explanation.
Yeah.
All based on a word that's so infrequently
used. That is so. It's somewhat puzzling that word gets so much attention in the sutta, and it's treated in such detail, and yet it doesn't figure prominently in other texts. This is my hypothesis. It could have been a word in current usage in that period amongst the different ascetic communities, the different tapasas, you know, the ascetics who were practicing austerities. And so the Buddha could have just taken that word over for special purposes and then given it a special meaning derived from his own system.
And the commentators don't have anything to say on
it. I looked in the commentary to this sutta. It was not very much. They didn't have very much to say.
It's a great mystery.
Yeah. Yeah.
This word, chitta,
yeah.
The rousing of the mind.
Yeah.
Is that similar to?
It's not exactly the same as intention, but I think it sort of emphasizes the intentional quality within the mind. But intention is a word which. I would say it's more the aspect of determination, resolution. But there's determination within that. There's intention within that. But I wouldn't just equate it flatly with intention. I'm just looking in the Siddhi Magga. Yeah, I think it's mentioned in a connection with the ascetic quality. Yeah, it's just said that the ascetic practices, like wearing rag robes exclusively for alms round, living at the foot of a tree, taking only one meal a day, sometimes living in a cemetery, these practices are considered to be forms of effacement, the salaka. It's not exactly the same, because samasankappa has a more limited meaning. Samasankappa, it's usually restricted to. That's what I would translate intention as sankappa, the intention of. It's usually explained the intention of renunciation, the intention of benevolence or goodwill, the intention of harmlessness. So it's just restricted to those three. Whereas chitta-upada can cover just about anything. And there can be, I guess, good, as well as good chitta-upadas, there can be bad chitta-upadas too. The arising of the mind in regard to unwholesome things. Though usually one doesn't have to make a strong effort to arouse the mind for unwholesome things. The mind goes there by its own inherent tendencies. But it's towards the wholesome that one has to arouse the mind or generate the mind. But citta maybe is considered to be the whole entirety of the mind, and intention to be one factor or force within the mind. But it's a force that becomes very prominent in this act of generating the mind. Suki, way in the back there. Yeah. The Veda Vitaka.
Right, first.
Yeah.
And then think.
Yeah.
And then become a mind.
Yeah.
And then chitta.
Hmm.
You have to arouse your mind.
Oh, that's an interesting way to see it. Yeah, maybe we could think of the first section as maybe the initial spontaneous arising of the mind in this way. Is that the way you would, what you mean? And then the second one, the production of the mind, the arousing of the mind, is more like a deliberate generation of the mind. That is a possibility. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely. Anyway, I think we've come to the end of our time. Actually, we are over the time limit. Okay, next time we will do very important sutra number 2 in the Majjhima Nikaya. That is the Sabbasata Sutta. Sutta on all the taints. Okay, we do the sharing of the merits. Sharing the merits. Producing the mind of sharing the merits with the devas. The nagas or dragon spirits, asking them to rejoice in the merits and protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect the exposition of the teaching, to protect ourselves and others. Then we share the merits with the devas and the Buddhas, the harmful spirits, asking them to rejoice in the merits and achieve all their good wishes, all their success. Akasata chumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anamodita chivam rakantu sasanam. Akasata chumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anamodita chivam rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata eva nagamhitika punyantam namohita shiram raham tumam raham eta rata chaham devi sampadam punya sampadam sabe deva anumodam tu sabha sampati siddhya. Eta vata charam hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabe buddha anumodantu sabha sampati siddhya. Eta vata charam hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabe sattva anumodantu sabha sampati siddhya.
Follow the Buddha.